Good morning, everyone. We need to review for the exam topics for Thursday, but before I do that, I wanted to go back over one of the topics we had talked about the other day, because we did step outside the textbook a fair bit when we talked about kinetics and thermodynamics. So I wanted to go over some of that same discussion again to help you know which parts of it you're going to be responsible for and which parts were really extra. So let's start with some of the terminology you do need to know, because it is mentioned in your textbook in regards to thermodynamics. You do need to know what a system is and what the surroundings are. So let me talk a little bit more about what a system is again to help define that term. In thermodynamics, we're always talking about where energy is originating from, where energy may end up. And so there needs to be some sort of boundary where we can talk about where does that energy initiate and where does the energy end up going to. And that's the purpose of defining what a system is. Most of the time in a chemical reaction, the system will include all of the chemicals that are participating in that reaction, and maybe the solvent as well. It would exclude things like the glassware, the physical setup, anything else that's in the room, so limited just the chemicals themselves. Sometimes it won't even include the solvent. It would literally just be the chemicals participating in a reaction. And that would be very much like the situation where if you're doing calorimetry using water. So if you might remember from the water chapter, we talked about specific heat and heat capacity, the fact that it takes a certain amount of energy in order to change the temperature of a substance. And I talked about how we could use water as a way of measuring the energy that's released by some other object. So I had described the case of taking a hot piece of metal, dropping it into the water. And so the metal, we could consider the system possibly, or we could consider the combination of the metal and the water. Well, similar situation happens if we're talking about chemical reactions. So if you have a chemical reaction that's releasing energy, we could focus and say just that reaction is the system. We could imagine that the water is then receiving that energy, and then from the perspective of the chemical reaction, we could define the terms endothermic and exothermic. So I'm not going to ask you to define what a system is in a particular situation. You just need to know in general what a system is, which is just a frame of reference. And it depends on whatever particular process we happen to be talking about. And then the surroundings would be everything else that doesn't include the system. So that bit of terminology you do need to know. Now, I had talked about state functions and path functions. Those you do not need to be able to talk about on the exam. Let me explain why I had wanted to talk about state functions and path functions. And the main reason is that in chemical reactions, it doesn't matter how a reaction occurs. The energy change in a chemical reaction is always going to be the same if you start with the same reactants and end up with the same products. And maybe that's a very intuitive concept. Maybe that makes sense automatically. But it doesn't necessarily come straight from the math related to the subject. If we want to think about it physically, though, if a molecule is nothing more than a set of atoms, and if the atoms have plus charges in the nucleus, and then you have the electrons that are the minus charges, it might make sense that if you bring atoms together and you have a certain arrangement of plus and minus charges, that sets up a certain amount of energy. And that's essentially what's going on. That doesn't matter how you create a molecule of sugar, one mole of sugar is going to act just like any other. So the process of getting you to that point is not what matters. It just matters what is the identity of the substance. If you were to read in a more advanced textbook, this is a principle known as Hess's Law, to say that it doesn't matter how a chemical reaction occurs, it just matters what the starting and ending points are. Just that part of the concept is all that I really care that you know, because it's related to this diagram that I had written. And it is just this portion of the diagram that I'd like you to be able to understand, where we had talked about starting with reactants and ending up with products, and how energy changes as you transition from one set to the other. This is a simplified diagram where essentially I'm just showing a one-step reaction. Just as a comparison, a reaction may sometimes have several different steps in it. And each time you go from one step in a reaction to another, we end up at the top of one of these hills, which is known as the transition state. And so that's an intermediate point that's in between reactants and products that's higher in energy than either the reactants or products. And all chemical reactions end up having some kind of transition state, even if the reaction might be something that's particularly favorable. So, for example, even though it's not the best idea to do, you could put hydrogen gas and oxygen gas together, and as long as there wasn't a spark, as long as there wasn't any kind of flame, they wouldn't interact or react, because it takes some amount of energy to start the process of hydrogen and oxygen reacting with each other. So that bit of energy that you have to add in to get up to this transition state is what is known as the activation energy. And again, that's why you take two things like hydrogen and oxygen, which if you aren't aware, hydrogen's extremely flammable. You give it a spark and it will easily burn in oxygen to form water. But without that spark, without that little bit of extra energy coming in, the reaction won't start. So that's the whole point of why I want you to know what a transition state is and what activation energy is because that's what prevents reactions from getting going. So to highlight the things that you really do need to know for the exam, even if I gave these definitions before, that's why I'm recovering them one more time, and I'm going to write these out. So the transition state is the highest energy point that occurs between reactants and products. And then activation energy is the energy needed to reach the transition state so that a reaction can occur. Now, I'm not going to mark up the other diagram here because I don't want to confuse us, but if you did have a more complicated reaction that had multiple steps, it is often the step that's the highest energy point or the step that has the largest activation energy which controls the rest of the reaction. And in fact, that might make somewhat sense because suppose that you're, for example, coming from east side over here, coming from Evergreen area. You know that at certain times of the day, it's right at that junction of 87 and 280 or maybe 880 and 280 that gets really backed up. And if you can get through those points, the rest of your trip probably isn't that bad. But there's this one point in your trip that's going to slow everything else down. And that's the same concept that happens in a chemical reaction, that there's often one step in a reaction that slows the rest of the reaction down, and it would be that particular activation energy that then you have to make sure that you get over for the reaction to occur. We're going to stick to the simplified diagram, though, of transition states, and we'll just assume everything's a single step like this. So you don't need to worry about the case of multiple reaction steps. Now, if you can understand what activation energy is, this energy needed to start a reaction process, that's why then I had written these graphs the other day, these energy distribution graphs. So, again, I'm repeating the story, but that's because some of this is outside of the text. And for those of you who are just getting here, I'm trying to highlight the topics that are outside the text a little bit that you do need to be familiar with the exam that's coming up on Thursday. So remember that this energy distribution diagram comes from the fact that not all molecules travel at the same energy. And just to remind us one last time where this topic comes up in real life, I had given the example of water evaporating at room temperature. Water has a normal boiling point of 100 degrees Celsius, so it shouldn't boil at room temperature, but it still manages to evaporate. And that's because even at room temperature, you've got a small fraction of molecules that are traveling at higher energy than the rest. And this is a situation that would naturally occur as soon as you put a group of molecules together. So the axes here represent the energy per molecule on the x-axis, and the number of molecules on the y-axis. And I'd drawn two different diagrams the other day to talk about two different situations. So one situation was related to how big of an activation energy do you have. And so let's say that you have a low activation energy for some particular process and a high activation energy for a different chemical process. Well, then we can see on the diagram that the higher the activation energy, the fewer the molecules that are going to have enough energy to react. Whereas if you have a low activation energy, a low barrier that the reaction has to cross over, then the reaction's going to occur more quickly because more molecules have that energy. So let me just summarize that as I might have the other day. When a reaction has a lower activation energy, the reaction occurs more quickly because more molecules will have the energy to reach the transition state. And so we put these ideas together, and that's how we came up with this diagram of how a catalyst works. So I did say that we weren't going to worry about a reaction of multiple steps, but the reason why I'm showing these two different curves is just to highlight that one of these corresponds to an uncatalyzed reaction, and one of these corresponds to a catalyzed reaction. And so the reason for showing different curves is to highlight the fact that it's two different reaction pathways. Because in very simple approaches to what a catalyst is, we usually just say, well, a catalyst speeds up a reaction. But how does it speed up the reaction? That's what I'm trying to get at here. So if you measure from the reactant up to the highest energy point in the uncatalyzed reaction, then you can see that that's going to have a larger activation energy than if the reaction had to reach up to the highest point of the catalyzed reaction. So even if we were to ignore the fact that there's multiple steps in one of these reactions, even if we just focused on the highest energy point in the reaction, we could see that the catalyzed reaction has a lower highest point. So based off of what I just said right up above, that means that the catalyzed reaction is going to occur more quickly because more molecules will have that energy to be able to reach that highest transition state. And that's exactly how a catalyst works. So a catalyst speeds up a reaction. By providing an alternate reaction pathway. That has a lower activation energy which therefore allows the reaction to occur more quickly. Now back to this idea of state functions. Again, part of the reason I brought the subject up is because you could see that no matter what the pathway is, the energy is the same for the reactants, regardless of which path we took, and the energy is the same for the products, regardless of which pathway we took. And that's the point of a state function. To repeat, doesn't matter how the chemicals are made, the amount of energy around just depends on what the chemicals are. Now, a catalyst does not change how much product is made, it just changes how quickly you're going to get to that product. And I don't know if I did this little simple demonstration the other day or not, but this might help make some sense of it. Chemical reactions don't necessarily just go in a forward direction. They can also, many reactions, go in a reverse direction, which is a very fundamental concept, but one that we frequently skip over in introductory chemistry classes. Even in the Chem 1A class, the Chem majors class, we don't talk about reversible reactions almost at all in the first quarter because there's too much other stuff that we're trying to get through. But in a reversible reaction, that means there's a balance between reactants and products. And what that balance ends up being depends just on what the energy of the reactants and products are. So what I want to demonstrate is this. If you imagine that from your perspective, my left hand are the reactants and my right hand are the products. This is a different type of graph than the one that's on the screen here. The one that's on the screen is related to one set of reactants going through a single case of the reaction. What I'm showing you with the piece of paper is what if you have billions and billions of the molecules all undergoing the chemical reaction. So then where the pen is sitting and the bottom of the paper represents the balance point of that reaction. And if you had reactants that were much higher in energy than products, you can see that the pen rolls on down towards the products, which reflects the fact in real life that if you have a process that's reversible, if the products are much lower in energy, well, the reaction's going to shift towards the products. If you have products that are much higher in energy than reactants, then the reaction's going to stick to the reactant side. Again, that's what the position of the pen is trying to represent. And the position of the pen represents what is that percentage of reactants and products that you end up with at the end of a reaction. So that balance, where do the reactants and products lie, depends only on what the energy of the reactants are and what the energy of the products are. Since a catalyst doesn't change any of that, because the identity of the reactants and products is all that determines that energy gap, then since a catalyst doesn't change the total energy involved, it doesn't change the balance of how many products and reactants you end up with at the end of a reaction. So that's another important aspect of a catalyst, but it's a little bit difficult more difficult concept to describe. So I just want to summarize it, since we did get through the kinetics part, talking about how quickly a reaction will occur. So catalysts do not change the amount of products formed, because a catalyst does not affect the total energy gained or released during a reaction. So then one of the last pieces of the puzzle that I remember discussing is this thing called a reaction coordinate diagram. So I had tried to describe this somewhat complicated situation of how would we calculate, using a computer model, how the energy changes as the reaction's going on. And I said, imagine that we take the position of every atom, we move them just a little bit at a time, and somehow calculate how much energy is there. And then I say, imagine that we traveled along the most favorable pathway, the lowest energy pathway through that landscape of possibilities. So that one pathway is what's called reaction coordinate. I'm not going to ask about the reaction coordinate on the exam. It's just I like filling in details where it's possible for us to do it. So all you need to know in terms of this diagram is that we're going from reactants to products. If you end up taking more advanced chemistry in the future, you're going to hear about this reaction coordinate, which is why I bring it up. The one part of the diagram you should be able to label is that it's energy that's the y-axis, how much energy is involved. So, there's a little bit more to these sections that I'll review when we go over our list of topics for the exam, but I wanted to have a chance to talk about catalysts and this effect of activation energy, because it's something that, although outside of the textbook, I feel is a logical enough concept that that's why I'm going to end up asking some questions about it. So now, knowing that you're going to have something related to this graph here, comparing a catalyzed and uncatalyzed reaction, and you're going to have something related to this energy distribution diagram, because it's been a couple of times now that we've seen that in class. Does anyone have any questions about any part of this topic at all? Since, as a class, this is the last time you get to interact with me before the exam. So I guess what I'm really asking is, if you've not had the chance to study yet, does the way that I presented this sound logical enough that you feel like you'll be able to go off and study it and understand it well enough for the exam? I see most people saying yes, which is a relief for two reasons. One, that I correctly guess this is not the worst of concepts. And two, I must have explained it at least decently enough that you're going to be able to take it home and digest it. Okay, does anyone have any questions at all on material related to anything we've talked about since the last exam? So that would include the bit of electrochemistry that we did, whatever we had talked about with water, the rest of our discussion about energy, or anything with biological molecules. I am going to review the biological molecules aspect so you know which parts of it you need to worry about as well. But did anyone have any questions before I moved on?
In terms of the whole chapter, I guess, on thermodynamics and kinetics, is that all we need to know from it?
There's a little bit more, and I'll talk about those portions when I do the summary of topics. So if I don't address your worries then let me know. Anyone else? Well, then we do need to continue with the chapter on biological molecules, because we only got to the beginning of our discussion of proteins. So let's return there. And it's going to take you a moment maybe to copy what I'm drawing, but I'd like to draw the structure of what's known as a tripeptide. Now, right at the very end of lecture last time, I started drawing peptides, which are combinations of amino acids. And hopefully you remember that an amino acid has two main functional groups on it, a carboxylic acid and an amino group. Many amino acids also have an additional functional group on what's called the side chain. So the essential structure of the amino acids that we're talking about in this chapter looks like this. They'll all have the amino group. They'll have the carboxylic acid, which I haven't finished writing in yet because I've got to connect something to it. And then they'll have something else attached at that carbon that both the amino group and the carboxylic acid group are attached to. So that side chain it's referred to influences heavily how that amino acid's going to behave, and we're going to talk about that behavior in just a moment here. So I just want to draw an example, though, of a tripeptide. Now, in a tripeptide, we don't have the carboxylic acid except for the very end amino acid, because the way that two amino acids are linked to each other is by an amide. So hopefully you can recognize what I've drawn here as an amide functional group. To help us out, I've danced around this term. I had considered not introducing it, but it's so commonly used that I might as well introduce it to you. So there's the term carbonyl, which is a carbon-oxygen double bond. That type of bond shows up in molecules so frequently that that's why it's given its own special name. So in more advanced classes, we'll often talk about carbonyl-containing compounds. So an amide is a carbonyl that has a nitrogen on it. A carboxylic acid is a carbonyl that has an alcohol on it. That's one way to remember the difference between the functional groups. So let me finish writing out this tripeptide. And you see at the very end of the tripeptide, we do have that carboxylic acid group because there's nothing else that's attached beyond it. So this tripeptide has a sequence of three amino acids, and there's no way I'm going to ask you to try to identify amino acids. There's that page of the 20 of them in the chapter, and in my organic chemistry class, which they're actually talking about exactly the same topic right now. It's kind of interesting coincidence. Because it's a much, much more advanced class, they have to memorize the amino acids. You all do not. So these happen to be the amino acids valine, alanine, and leucine. So there's what's known as the sequence of a protein chain. Protein and polypeptide, those are terms that are somewhat interchangeable. Your text mentions that past a certain size, polypeptide starts being called a protein, but there's not necessarily a hard limit. So if I end up using the terms interchangeably, that's why. But in either case, I'm talking about these chains of amino acids. And how these chains behave depends on exactly the order of the amino acids, which is known as the sequence. So the sequence is the order of amino acids in a polypeptide or protein. The sequence is listed from the amino end to the acid end. So we can remember the term amino acid. You can remember the way that sequences are written from the amino end to the acid end. So that's why I wrote the molecule the direction I did, since we're operating in a left-to-right language in English. And that's why I've listed this as valine, alanine, leucine. Now, protein chains can sometimes have hundreds or thousands of amino acids. So instead of naming the chains with the full names, there are three-letter abbreviations that are sometimes used. So this might be called val, ala, lu, which, again, you don't need to memorize, but I'm just showing you an example of how this could be named. There are one-letter abbreviations as well, and some of them are logical. So in this case, it would reduce down to VAL. There are some amino acids, though, that start with the same letters. So there's some of the amino acids that have one-letter abbreviations that don't instantly make sense. But again, that's because we have common letters for some of the amino acids. For example, leucine starts with L, but so does lysine, which I don't remember the one-letter abbreviation for lysine my own self without looking at it. But this gives you an example of sequence. Now, how or why does this sequence matter? Well, let me use the text to show you this, because it's got much better pictures than what I would be able to put into the notes. Because there are four levels of structure that proteins have. And I'll write these four levels in the notes after I show you the pictures. The first level of structure is actually what I've already shown you here, what the order of amino acids is. But the reason that matters is because the amino acids can interact with each other. So sometimes the amino acids can interact like this. So this is showing a sample of a long protein chain that's wrapped around on itself. And you can see that in this chain, you have hydrogens and oxygens that are opposite of each other from one chain to the next. Well, those can approach each other to the right distance for there to be heavy hydrogen bonding to go on between the chains. And that causes these chains to fold into sheet-like structures. So your text gives the term beta-pleated sheet. And that's the geometry of these planar type of structures. Another type of structure that can form is a helix. Not the same helix as we're going to see in a moment in DNA, but a helix where the chains are able to coil on top of themselves. So this type of coiling is something that happens in fibers such as wool. So that's partly what gives wool the ability to stretch without necessarily snapping. And not worrying about the identity of the amino acids here, you could see that with the right amino acid combination, you get these hydrogen bonding interactions that lock the amino acids into a chain, into a helix. This is the second structure of proteins. The first form of structure is just the order that proteins come in. The second order of structure is these local geometries that the amino acids will make just by interacting with themselves. But there's even a further interaction that can occur where over the entire length of the protein, there might be some larger shape that develops. So this is an example of the molecule myoglobin, which is related to hemoglobin, as we'll see in just a moment. So from one end to another, this is just a massive chain, which it's trying to indicate a large portion of it is in some kind of helical configuration. But there are still these attractions that go on between different amino acids that pull this into a particular shape. So that shape that's formed by the whole protein interacting, that's the third level of protein structure. Then there's one last level of structure where you can have these large protein units that end up being attracted to each other, sometimes by nothing more than dispersion forces. And so this is a picture of what hemoglobin looks like. One huge molecule that's made up of four individual units. So this is the fourth level of protein structure. to see how do the individual units fit together. Now, your text does talk a little bit more about these types of structures, to talk about the kind of linkages or kind of attractions that can happen between different amino acids. So I've already talked about the fact that hydrogen bonding can occur. But some of the amino acids have an extra acid. Some of the amino acids have an extra base and an extra amino group. And that's on the side chain. So lysine, for example, is an example of an amino acid that has an extra amino group. Aspartic acid is another example of an amino acid that has a carboxylic acid group. So when the amino group, which is a base, encounters a carboxylic acid, which is an acid, the two can interact and you end up with a proton transferring from one to the other. Well, if a carboxylic acid loses a proton, it becomes negatively charged. If the amino group gains a proton, it ends up being positively charged. And so you have a charge interaction that causes those two amino acids to be pulled together. Some amino acids have sulfur as part of their side chains. One amino acid in particular is cysteine. And those sulfurs can react to form what are known as disulfide linkages. I remember way back in grade school learning about the disulfide linkages as being one of the ways in which if you get a perm, get a hairstyle, that that's held together, by causing the sulfurs in bits of hair to end up linking together. So that's a full covalent bond that's linking those amino acids together. The opposite of that, and I've already mentioned this as a possibility, is to have dispersion forces, which if you didn't have any other type of forces of around, dispersion forces sometimes end up mattering a lot because at least it's some form of attraction. So you don't need to know the identities of the amino acids, and you only need to know in general that these different types of interactions are possible. I'm going to tell you that I'm not going to ask at all about the four structures of proteins because that's more of a biologically related question. Exactly what I will ask, I'll review when I do the topics over the exam, most likely after the break. But there is a little bit more about proteins that's mentioned, and this is related to something I've brought up in class before. So even if this part's not on the exam, I wanted to talk about it just for a moment. I've mentioned several times now that the way that enzymes work, enzymes being biological catalysts, is that they have some kind of receptive site, some type of geometry to them that allows them to interact with specific molecules. So let's say, for example, that you have sucrose, blood sugar. There's an enzyme that can break that down into two individual sugar units, fructose and glucose, glucose being blood sugar. That process can occur just by reacting it with water, but an enzyme can do it much more quickly because enzymes are built to have this reactivity. They're like little machines that are specialized to operate on specific molecules. And so that's what the diagram in your text is trying to show, that you have an active site and then what's called the substrate, the molecule that protein is going to act on, that enzyme is going to act on. And when the substrate is able to settle into that site, the enzyme does its trick. It causes a chemical reaction that changes the substrate, and then the enzyme is released to go about and do its job all over again. Now, one interesting detail that I didn't go over is the fact that there's ways to switch enzymes on and off. So allosteric, what that's related to is the shape of a protein itself. And so a moment ago I said that the fact that an enzyme can do the job it does because it has a particular shape that matches the substrate. Well, what if something else can react with the protein that changes the structure of the protein. Then the protein is no longer able to interact with its substrate, which means it's not able to do its job. So it's a way, biologically, of the body being able to switch enzymes on and off so that they work when it needs to, but you can turn them off when it's not needed. So that's what the text is showing with this allosteric site. So that's our discussion about proteins. Now, we've got a big topic ahead, which is DNA. So section two, we did a lab this morning where we isolated the DNA from, turned out we used bananas, just to be able to see the strands of DNA that could be isolated. I want to talk about what the structure of DNA is, and then I'm going to run out of time before the break. And so then after the break, I'll talk a little bit about how DNA functions. It's very likely that some of the simpler parts of this will be on the exam, like what goes into a unit of DNA, you could say. But how DNA behaves, I probably won't include on the exam because, again, it's very much a bio-related topic, not as much of a chemistry-related topic. So focusing on the chemistry side of things, there are these two large molecules, DNA and RNA, that can be broken down into units called nucleotides, which can be further broken down into three specific pieces. So if I'm talking about RNA, the R in RNA stands for ribose. So this is ribonucleic acid. So the structure of ribose, which you don't have to memorize, looks like this. In cyclic format, it has this structure. So ribose is a carbohydrate, a sugar. If we look at each carbon has a connection to at least one oxygen. In DNA, ribose exists in its cyclic form. So there's one carbon that ends up with attachments to two different oxygens. Now there's two other units that go into this. One is phosphate. So in this format that I've shown, this is dihydrogen phosphate. Phosphate would be the molecule with all of the hydrogens removed. So this is one of the units. The other unit that goes into this is some kind of nitrogen-containing base. And so I'm going to just draw an example of one of these bases. Now, these are Bronsted-Lowry bases because, as you can see, there's nothing in the structure that looks at all like a hydroxide. So it's the fact that there are nitrogens here that it's able to act as a base. So this particular molecule is adenine. Which is a nitrogen base. You put the three of these things together, the nitrogen base, a molecule of sugar, of ribose, and then the phosphate, and that's what creates a nucleotide, which since it's in your textbook, let me just go ahead and show you the structure of all the pieces put together. So you can see that the nitrogen of the base has taken one of the oxygens from the sugar and replaced it. And on the other side here, one of the other oxygens has been replaced by the phosphate group. So then how does DNA get constructed? One of these three-unit nucleotides is attached to the next, is attached to the next. That part's not shown in your text, but it's right where my pen is, this OH group that is at the bottom left-hand side of the ring. That would be connected to another phosphate, which is then connected to another sugar with another one of these nitrogen bases. So the essential structure of DNA is this chain that goes phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, where each sugar has one of these nitrogen bases on it. Now, again, focusing on the chemistry side, there are four bases that end up in DNA, four bases that end up in RNA. So three of the bases are the same for both DNA and RNA. And two of them are these two cyclic units, that's adenine and guanine. And then another one of these is a single ring compound, which is cytosine. The last of the four bases is different in DNA versus RNA. And your text doesn't explain this, but it has to do with how much energy the body uses to maintain these molecules. So you have thiamine that shows up in DNA, uracil that shows up in RNA. And it turns out that uracil is more reactive, which RNA is not something that permanently sticks around in the body. It's DNA that's used to pass on genetic information. So the body uses its energy to make thiamine when that information needs to stick around. Otherwise, it just uses uracil, which has the potential to react more, but RNA, like I said, is something that usually sticks around temporarily. Kind of the same situation occurs in which sugars are used. So RNA uses ribose. DNA uses deoxyribose. Deoxy means something without oxygen. And you can see that the diagrams have been labeled with carbon numbers. So if you look at carbon number 2, which is the second one from the right-hand side, in ribose, we do have an OH group located at that position. In deoxyribose, which is what shows up in DNA, you can see that OH group is missing. And again, it's related to how reactive the molecule is, that the deoxyribose ends up less susceptible to reaction, but biologically it costs a bit more energy to make. So that's why DNA has it versus the more, disposable RNA has that more reactive OH group. So after the break, we'll talk a bit more about the structure, the function of DNA. But this is a good stopping point for the moment. For those of you who are listening in from home, what I've now done is switched over to the computer and pulled a diagram that is off of Wikipedia because it shows a little bit more about the structure of how DNA units are linked together that's not shown in the text. So in yellow on this particular diagram, we have the phosphate groups. And as you can see, they connect two different sugar units. Since this is DNA we're talking about, then this is deoxyribose. The structure's been simplified, but it's still, you can see that five-membered ring format. So one of the deoxyriboses connects to a phosphate, connects to another deoxyribose, and so on and so forth. And you notice that on each of the sugar units, there's one of these nitrogen bases that's attached. Now, this is the truly amazing part of what the structure of DNA is that occurs here. Because DNA actually occurs as a double helix, where it's two of these chains that are automatically associated with each other. And these chains are connected only by hydrogen bonding, and they're connected by exactly the particular bases that are interacting with each other. So as you can see in this diagram, there are four different bases that are possible. And adenine on one base exactly lines up with thiamine on the other chain, and guanine automatically lines up with cytosine. To see a little bit better those structures, the text does have a picture of that interaction in it. And it turns out that those interactions have exactly the same distances for the two different types of bases. So again, on the left, we have adenine and thymine. On the right, we have guanine and cytosine. The difference between these is that one of these only has two hydrogen bonding interactions. The other one has three hydrogen bonding interactions. But it's because those molecules fit so perfectly with each other that's what ends up forming this double helix strand. And this is the way that information is encoded in DNA, by the order that the bases are in. Now, to explain a little bit what goes on, DNA is the source of the information from which proteins are generated. And the way that that occurs is the following. When DNA is going to be copied, it splits apart and undergoes what's known as transcription. And so that's where molecules assemble to form a set of what's called messenger RNA. So the same genetic information that's the order of the bases that's in DNA is replicated into RNA. And then what happens is that you have what's known as transfer RNA, tRNA, which is a much smaller molecule. The essential structure of that molecule is shown in the text, and let me explain what's being shown here. It turns out that the nitrogen bases occur in three base units, which are known as codons. That's the most elementary piece of genetic information that you can break DNA down into. That codon has a tRNA, a transfer RNA, that will attach to it based off of these opposite base pair pairings. So that's what the text is trying to show you, that along the, in this case, RNA chain itself, we have one of these three base sequences, and the opposite three bases are found on this tRNA. At the other end of the tRNA is a particular amino acid. So this one happens to be the tRNA that's associated with valine. Remember that it's hydrogen bonding that allows the bases to interact with each other. So only the right tRNA molecule with the right opposite codon is going to line up with the codon itself. So first, when DNA is split apart, it's copied into RNA, and then all of these tRNA molecules line up with the RNA. And then as the tRNA lines up, it brings with them the amino acids in sequence. There's another set of molecules that come along and links each amino acid together, and this just follows the RNA chain to build certain types of proteins. So the different combinations of three bases is also shown in your text. And there's some duplication of information here. There's also what is known as the stop or termination codon. It's a way of signaling that the protein is done being made and for that entire process to stop. So I know that's a very short explanation of it, but that's essentially what occurs when RNA is translated into a protein. So now I guess what we should do is to go ahead and go over the test topics. And let me pull up the most recent notes. Okay, so from the end of the previous exam, the first new topic was in electrochemistry, which I remember even before we did this. I want to take one more example of determining oxidation states, determining what was oxidized, what was reduced, because that was the one problem from the quiz that as a class, by far, you had the most trouble with. So I want to do one of those examples even before we review the rest of the topics. So I'm pulling this example reaction from a lab that's actually performed in the Chem 1A class. So just to read it out as I write it, we have potassium iodate, that's what this IO3 ion is called, that reacts with potassium iodide along with sulfuric acid in order to form iodine, potassium sulfate, and water. So if you were given an equation like this, the first thing you need to do in order to figure out what was oxidized, what was reduced, what's the oxidizing agent, what's the reducing agent, you have to figure out what each of the oxidation states is. Now, one point of confusion that I've realized after discussing with someone in office hours is there's a difference in the approach we take to come up with the oxidation states. There's a difference between that and deciding what is the oxidizing agent. And so specifically, for example, with this first substance, if we wanted to determine the oxidation states of potassium iodate, we follow the normal rules, which are that in most compounds, oxygen's going to have a -2 oxidation state. This one doesn't have any hydrogens, but if it did, hydrogen is almost always in its +1 oxidation state. So we would automatically look at this and say, okay, each oxygen is going to have an oxidation state of -2. And then you might say, okay, well, that means that it's going to be an oxidizing agent because it has oxygen in it. But those two are not related concepts. Figuring out what the oxidation state is different than figuring out how the substance is going to react. One way of explaining that is that if oxygen already is in its -2 oxidation state, that means it's already reacted to gain electrons. Because why would oxygen end up -2? Because of its position on the periodic table. The fact that it's only two columns away from being in this octet configuration is why it likes to end up being -2. So if it's already -2, that means the oxygen itself is not going to react any further. And so the oxygen is not automatically going to cause potassium or iodine, either one, to be an oxidizer or reducer. We have to look at the reactants and products in order to figure that aspect out. So saying that oxygen is one of the most electronegative elements is just to explain why we end up with the oxidation states that we do. So oxygen has a state of -2. How do we figure anything else out in this compound? We have to recognize that there are ions involved. And iodate is not an ion that you learned in your table of ions. So I would need to give you that information if I gave you this reaction on an exam. But once you knew that, then you could look at it and say, well, potassium, that's likely an ion as well. And potassium, because it exists in the first column of the periodic table, that means that potassium wants to have a +1 charge. And if a potassium is an ion all by itself, remember that ions, if they only contain one atom, charge and oxidation state are exactly the same thing. So now we know what the charge of potassium is. We know what the oxidation state of oxygen is. How can we figure out what iodine is? Well, there's another rule that says the sum of all the oxidation states has to add up to what the overall charge of the substance is. The overall charge is zero because in the equation, nothing was written. If this was going to have a charge, it would be written in somehow. So iodine has to be something that balances out the potassium and oxygens. So what number would balance everything out? So it turns out it's going to be +5. And the reason for that is because I wrote -2 for oxygen, but realized that each oxygen is -2. To turn that around, if I ask you for the oxidation state of oxygen, it's not -6. That's what the combination of all the oxygens gives us. But each individual oxygen is only a -2 oxidation state. So all the oxygens put together would be -6. Put the potassium with that, we get a total of -5. And so for the whole substance to be balanced out, that means that iodine needs to be +5. Then we have this other reagent, potassium iodide. That's going to be an ionic compound because you have potassium from one side of the periodic table, iodine on the other side of the periodic table. Potassium's in that first column, so it's got to be a +1. And iodine is in the same column as chlorine and bromine. And we know from back earlier in the quarter, that means it's going to want to be -1. So now we have those oxidation states. For sulfuric acid, I think the quiz had a problem that involves sulfuric acid. So I'll move through that one quickly. We have oxygen that's going to be -2 because that's its regular oxidation state. Hydrogen that's going to be +1. We have 4 oxygens, so that would add up to a total of -8. We have 2 hydrogens, so that would be +2. You put those together, and you would get so far -6. So in order for everything to balance out, that means sulfur is going to have to be +6. So now we have all the reagents taken care of. Let's look at the products. We can take a few shortcuts because you can see sulfate in the reactant. You can see sulfate in the product. Sulfate is still the same ion no matter which substance it's in. So we can automatically just jump and say that sulfur is still going to be +6 because oxygen is still going to be -2 and potassium likes to be +1 just like hydrogen does. So that one we can fill out relatively easily. Now, water only has hydrogen and oxygen in it. And so hydrogen's going to automatically be +1. Oxygen's going to be -2. The only thing left is iodine, the product, which what is the oxidation state going to be there? 0, because it's an element in its regular elemental form. I2 is the way that iodine normally exists. So since it is like it hadn't reacted, that's why it ends up with an oxidation state of 0. So now we look at what oxidation states changed. And we can see that potassium iodate, this KIO3, iodine went from +5 to 0. So that's what? Oxidation or reduction? For iodine in this substance itself, it got oxidized or it got reduced? I was reduced. And if it helps you out to remember, when we're talking about reduction, we mean reduction of oxidation state. And since we go from a +5 to a 0, that means that number's getting smaller, which means it got reduced. The other way to think about it, if you want to think about it chemically, is that negative charges cause the oxidation state to get lower. So if the oxidation state's getting lower, that's because it gained electrons. And remember that reduction is a gain of electrons. So that means that iodine was reduced. But that means that potassium iodate was the oxidizing agent, which, in case that's still confusing to you somehow, it's all a matter of perspective. So again, we know that iodine gained electrons because it went from a plus 5 to a zero oxidation state. Well, if it gained electrons, it took them from somewhere else. So it caused something else to lose electrons, so it caused something else to be oxidized, which is why KIO3 ends up the oxidizing agent. If you point to one of the products and try to say, oh, that's what got oxidized, well, no, because the product's what you end up with after the process is all over with. So the thing that got reduced, the thing that got oxidized, the reducing agent, the oxidizing agent, they're all reagents. None of those can be products because the products are what you end up with after everything's over. So a reduction can't happen without an oxidation, so now we got to look for where oxidation occurs. And curiously enough, it also involves iodine in this case, just a different substance with iodine. So here in iodide, it went from negative 1 to 0, which means iodine in that substance was oxidized. Again, two ways you could state that, because the oxidation state itself increases. So if you're going up in oxidation state, that means you got oxidized. Why would that happen? Because you're losing negative charge. You're losing an electron, and losing electrons is oxidation. But that means that Ki was the reducing agent. Again, a matter of perspective. We say that iodine in Ki was oxidized, but that means that the electrons were given to something else. Something else had to take those electrons. That means something else got reduced. So potassium iodide is the reducing agent. I'm just straight up telling you that you're going to have one of these problems on your exam. So that's why I wanted to go through another example, because I do feel it's important to know how to come up with oxidation states and how to recognize what's reduced and oxidized. Question, yes?
On that first KIO3,
yes.
You knew that K was plus 1 because it's got an ionic bond to the iron.
The other way we know it is because of the position on the periodic table. Potassium really can't be anything else except plus 1. No, the first three. So first three and last three. If you can figure out that they're in ionic form at all, then we follow the periodic table to come up with their normal charges.
So how would you know whether to give the potassium or the iodine, the plus one?
That's why it would help to know that iodate is an ion, because then you know that oxygen is connected to iodine, and you know that iodine is not all on its own. So when it's part of a compound, the normal oxidation state rules don't necessarily apply. So in other words, any example I give you in class or on the exam would involve substances that you'd be familiar enough with that there wouldn't be any guesswork involved. Are there any other questions on this example? Okay, now let's go back and talk about the exam topics. So the first one is going to be on this, oxidation states and determining oxidizers and reducers. Looking back at the other notes that we had from that same day, enough people did well enough with the discussion of batteries, the electrochemical cell, that I'm not going to put that back on the exam again, because it just wouldn't really make much sense to. So let's see what else that we have then. We already got electrochemical cells, so that means we're skipping over anodes and cathodes, we're skipping over salt bridges, and so that brings us up to organic molecules. Let's see. Yes, give me just a moment. So for the oxidation reduction, that would be, it's not going to be all of it, though, all of these sections, because we're skipping a lot of it, but it's mostly in section 8.1. There is some mention of what oxidation and reduction agents are in 8.2. So I'll say 8.1 and 8.2. Now, for organic molecules, another question? Yes.
Oxidizer is just the same thing as oxidizer.
Oxidizing agent, that's correct. Yes. Will not be on the exam again, no. Right. Now, moving on to the organic chemistry chapter. That's chapter 9. Let me figure out the appropriate sections here. So, first off, you have isomers. And I had said that because we had the review in lab over different types of isomers, that you did need to know more specifically types of isomers now. So the two types that you needed to know were constitutional isomers and stereoisomers. There were two flavors of stereoisomers, and one of them's easier to remember than the other. So one version of stereoisomers involves double bonds that are cis versus trans, and the other form of stereoisomer are the 3D isomers that we get due to tetrahedral geometry. So you at least need to know about the cis-trans isomers, because those are the ones that are actually in your text. And so in your text, the topic of isomers comes up in section 8.1. And that includes the stereoisomers. So this is section 8.1. Now, you still need to know what the terms saturated and unsaturated mean, because those came up in our discussion of fats. And let me check, but I believe that's the same section number. Oh, I'm sorry, you're right, 9.1. And yes, saturated, unsaturated, that's also 9.1. Now I'm forgetting, if we're writing molecules down, then that means this time you need to know how to handle line structures. Did anybody need or want a review of line structures after we list the topics out? I see a few people saying yes. Okay, so we'll do that at the end after we get our list of topics. So we have our line structures. I'm not going to ask anything about the discussion of bonding that we went over. So I'm not going to ask about benzene, because it's hard to talk about benzene without talking about bonding. And then cyclic compounds, I might have mentioned there's the term cyclo, but there's nothing else to ask other than the fact that you can have cyclic compounds. So I won't ask about cyclic compounds either. That means the only things left are the functional groups. And those include the functional groups that we've had since the quiz. So I can see from the notes that at the time of the quiz, there were only seven groups you were responsible for. The hydrocarbons, oh dear, that's another term. So hydrocarbons including alkanes, alkenes, and alkynes. Then we had some oxygen-containing groups, alcohol, ether, aldehyde, and ketone. Since the quiz, we've had a few more groups, specifically carboxylic acid, ester, amine, and amide. So I'll just say for functional groups, all in text, meaning that I'm only going to ask about the ones that are listed in the text, but all the ones that are listed there. And there's a table in section 9.4 that lists all the functional groups together. Now, if it helps at all, when we get to the biological molecules, some of these functional groups are the main ones that show up in the biological molecules. So you might remember us talking about fatty acids, which are examples of carboxylic acids. We talked about a fat molecule, a triglyceride, which is an ester. Earlier today, we were talking about amino acids that have the amine group, or amino. And then when you put amino acids together, you get an amide. So these new functional groups since the quiz have direct places they show up in the biological molecule section. Now, you don't need to memorize any of the specific examples of molecules that were in any of the sections here where it talked about functional groups. You just need to be able to identify the different functional groups. So that takes us all the way through the rest of the chapter, I believe. Yes. So that's it on the organic molecules. The next chapter, then, would be chapter 14, which was on water. And I think everything was in section 14.1. Yes, it was. So the topics related to water were its unusual density. The fact that water expands when it freezes because of the extensive hydrogen bonding that occurs in water. We have the fact that water is amphoteric. The fact that water can act as both an acid and a base. And then we have specific heat. Two things there. One, that water has a high specific heat, but we also have this formula that came out of the section, which is that the amount of energy that you would have to add in order to change the temperature of water depends on a physical property of water itself, its specific heat, times the amount of water that you have, its mass, times the temperature change that's occurring. Now, I won't ask any calorimetry questions. That came up, the topic of calorimetry, when we were discussing the section. But that's a more advanced concept not really supported by the text. But at the least, you need to know what specific heat is. As far as a definition, specific heat is the amount of energy needed to raise 1 gram of a substance 1 degree either Celsius or Kelvin. Now remember, if we're talking about delta T, which means change in temperature, the change in 1 degree Celsius is the same size as change of 1 Kelvin. So you don't have to convert from Celsius to Kelvin in order to do these problems. You just take the difference in temperature, it'll automatically come out correct. So that's it for chapter 14. Then we move on to thermodynamics and kinetics, chapter 15. So at the beginning of class today, we did a review of some of the topics. And so some of the terminology you need to know are system and surroundings. And then you need to know what exothermic and endothermic mean. Exothermic means that energy is being released by the system. Endothermic means that energy is being absorbed by the system. To just help emphasize that, you know that we talked about the sign of the energy involved. So if a system is losing energy, that means it ends up with less energy than it started with. So that's a negative energy change. If you have something absorbing energy, that means its energy content is going up. And so that means it's a positive energy change. So endothermic and exothermic, those are mentioned in section 15.2. Also in 15.2 is a discussion of bond energies. So you might remember we had discussed about hydrogen and chlorine, I believe it was, yes, reacting with each other. And we talked about how we could calculate the amount of energy involved that in that reaction by looking at the bonds breaking versus the bonds forming. So remember that to break a bond costs energy. In other words, bond breaking is an endothermic process. Bond formation is something that's favorable. So that's an exothermic process where energy is released. So in the example we did in class, we looked at how many bonds are breaking, how many bonds are forming, and we could use that information to come up with what is the energy change in a reaction. So you'd likely be expecting a similar problem to exactly the example that we had done in class. That's still in section 6.2. So then we get to the concept of catalysts and rates in section 15.3. Remember that we did step outside the text a little bit, and that's why we did the review at the beginning. So along with catalysts, I do want you to know what activation energy is. And therefore, what a transition state is. To go along with both of those concepts, we have the energy distribution diagram. That's the diagram that shows the energy that molecules will have at a particular temperature. It's this graph. The one that we use to show that a fraction of molecules are going to have a certain amount of energy. And remember that we use that graph to explain why changes in activation energy cause change in rate. I'm not going to ask at all about entropy, and I'm not going to ask about the first law of thermodynamics, so you don't need to worry about section 15.4. Those are really fundamental concepts, but they're really kind of beyond the level of the course. So that's it from that chapter, which means we go to the last chapter on biological molecules, chapter 16. And looking at the rest of the topics I've already gone on here, I think there's only three types of molecules I'm going to ask about. One would be carbohydrates. So I think for this level of class, it wouldn't be helpful, useful for you to memorize different carbohydrate structures. So I don't want you to have to memorize what sucrose is versus lactose versus maltose. But some of the terminology that we covered, you do need to know. So you do need to know what monosaccharides and disaccharides are. Remember, the difference is how do they interact with water? If you react sugar with water and it can't be broken down any further, that means it's a monosaccharide, a single sugar unit. And that includes examples like glucose, blood sugar. A disaccharide, that would be something like table sugar, sucrose, that when you react it, it is able to be broken down into two smaller sugar units. There's different functional groups in different types of carbohydrates. And so we have the terms aldose and ketose. Aldoses are sugars that have an aldehyde functional group. Ketoses are sugars that have a ketone functional group. Given how complicated it is to try to draw and explain, I'm not going to ask about the alpha versus beta linkages that are in the polysaccharides. So we did talk about starch versus cellulose, but I don't think it's quite appropriate for me to expect you to be able to draw and explain those. So just this little bit of terminology is what you need to know from carbohydrates. And that's section 16.2. Then 16.3 is essentially all about fats. So you do need to know in general what fatty acids are without memorizing any specific structures. So fatty acids in general are long-chain carboxylic acids. We've already talked about the difference between unsaturated and saturated fats. So you need to be able to identify whether a fatty acid is saturated or unsaturated. And then I do want you to know what a triglyceride is, because that is a fat molecule. That is a combination of glycerol and then fatty acids. It is a ester. So that's it from section 16.3. Then the last will be proteins, which is section 16.4. Gesundheit. So you do need to know what amino acids are in general. Again, not memorizing any specific structures, but just to write it out so you have a better expectation of what I'm going to be asking about. I had said that the types of amino acids that we're worried about are ones where there's a carbon that is connected to both an amino group and a carboxylic acid group. And on that same carbon, there's also some form of side chain, some additional functional group. So that is the most simplified structure of these amino acids that we are studying. Now, there's what is sometimes called a peptide bond, or I'll call it a peptide linkage. Which is an amide. It's the way that amino acids are combined together to form peptides, which are essentially proteins. The last thing I would want you to know is what we talked about earlier with sequencing. That the sequence is the order that amino acids show up in a protein, and that they are listed from the amino end to the acid end. I'm not going to ask you about any of the larger forms of protein structure, so you do not have to worry about section 16.5. And even though enzymes have come up as a topic in class multiple times now, I'm not going to ask you specifically about enzymes either. Then, looking at the number of topics we have, I think I'm going to leave out DNA entirely from the exam. Because really to have a discussion of DNA is a bit beyond the course, other than just briefly seeing the types of molecules involved in DNA. So this will suffice as our list of topics for the exam. Now, there was a request to do a little bit of line structure review. So we got just a few minutes to be able to do that. And since we don't have a heck of a lot of time, I'll just go ahead and do an example for you all. And I'll use one of the amino acids to do it. So I showed the structure of leucine earlier. So here I will replicate it again. And let me remind you what goes into making a line structure. So if I had the fully written out structure, the way to go to a line structure is the following. Anywhere where there's a carbon label, you leave the carbon label out. And if you have hydrogens attached to carbon, you leave those hydrogens out. Now, I'm not going to ask about the term, but I did define the term heteroatom, which is where you have something that's not carbon, something that's not hydrogen. So in this case, we have nitrogen and oxygen that are heteroatoms. You don't make any assumptions about what are attached to heteroatoms. So that's why even in this line structure, you see a hydrogen written in for the oxygen. You see hydrogens written in for the nitrogen. Now, this is slightly condensed because you're missing the bonds between nitrogen and hydrogen. You're missing the bond between oxygen and hydrogen. But that's because we can identify that as a functional group. So sometimes visually, it makes it easier to identify functional groups when we leave those bond lines out. And so that's why I drew the molecule the way I did here. When we go back and we have to expand, remember that everywhere where there's a label missing, everywhere where the structure changes direction, that means there's a carbon located at that position. So if I wanted to go back and just put the carbons in, this is what it would look like. So there's a total of 6 carbons in the molecule. The 2 carbons in the central part of the chain, and then 4 carbons that are attached down below here. Then we fill in the rest of the molecule with hydrogens. And remember, the rule there is that carbon should have 4 bonds of some sort to it. Triple bonds count for 3, double bonds count for 2. So this top carbon that's in the carboxylic acid already is complete because it's already got 4 bonds to it. The carbon to the left is missing a hydrogen because it only has 3 bonds shown. The carbon below that needs 2 hydrogens, because there's only 2 bonds shown. The next carbon after that, again, has 3 bonds being shown, so it needs 1 additional hydrogen. And then the 2 other carbons that are left over only have 1 bond each being shown, and so they need 3 hydrogens on them. Yes? So you may have to go either direction. I might give you the expanded structure like this and you have to go to the line structure, or you might have the line structure and need to go to the expanded structure.
So no formulas.
No formulas to structures, no. Because unless I do a good job of writing the formula, formulas often don't have enough information.
Okay.